Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Austin and Jim, welcome this morning. We've been, we and others have been pouring more troops into Afghanistan, and things have heated up down south. The question is in my mind, is what the effect of the numbers of troops are going to be there, and if they're going to be effective or if they're just going to be more targets. And that's sort of my, where I'm coming from at this point. I just, you know, have no idea if in that terrain and that situation, if more troops are going to make that much of a difference.
All right, there's two things going on here that doesn't get reported for whatever reason. First, the new guy, McChrystal, being Special Forces, he, better than any other general, and that's why he replaced a guy who was pretty good, understands what's going on the ground. I've never met a Special Forces guy, especially a 5th Group one, who wasn't amused by the situation in Afghanistan. I mean, one guy said it's basically the Wild West with big, big mountains. You've got those tribes up there in the hills, and it's 19th century or worse. And that is the bottom line in there. Like Austin, you said, you know, Bishop Tutu, you know, patted you on the back for recognizing the same sort of cultural, socioeconomic, you know, situation in Africa. Well, it's the same in Afghanistan. People keep forgetting Afghanistan is the poorest country in Eurasia. That's pretty damn poor. And the reason they're poor is because there's no there there. That's where you get the famous nobody's ever conquered Afghanistan. That's because there's nothing to conquer. You know, people have conquered the parts of it that were worth anything, which, quite frankly, was never much and not for long. The Silk Route used to go through there, and during that period, Iran controlled part of it, China, whatever. But be that as it may, you still have an ancient situation. You've got to deal with tribes. Now, the other problem, which is linked with the tribes, is what's going on there. The Taliban are actually a secondary problem with Afghanistan. Granted, the main thing is the only reason we're in there, this empire is in there, is because of the possibility, very real, that the Taliban or whoever is running the place after if we just get up and leave, will give the terrorists sanctuary. And who wouldn't? If the terrorists are willing to pay, although they paid somewhat, they basically preyed upon the religious affiliation and the push to law. And the tradition, which is, you know, if it's a guy with a good line of crap, you know, you give him shelter. But the only way you can deal with the tribal problem is to deal with the money problem. And the money problem is linked in with the drugs. It's all about heroin. And, of course, people are recognizing that now. Now, of course, you read our Afghanistan coverage, and you'll see, for years, I mean, 10 years ago we were talking about this. It's all about the drugs. And, you know, a lot of people conveniently forget that the Taliban were never down on the drugs. They taxed it. That's how they paid their way. One year, they stopped cultivation because they had too much product. They were driving their own prices down. So, as very intelligent businessmen, they listened to somebody said, well, just stop shipping for a year and work off your inventory, which is exactly what they did. They also did it because they were pulling a scam on the West. We were saying that, hey, if you stop the drugs, we'll give you foreign aid. And they put two and two together and said, hey, we can stop for a year, collect the foreign aid, work off our inventory, and then pick up production after we've stolen as much foreign aid as we can in a year. And that's exactly what they did. And at the same time, they were giving, you know, aid, comfort, and sanctuary to terrorists who were plotting, you know, massive attacks, not just on the United States, but all over the West. So what it comes down to is if you shut down the heroin production, which is what the troops are doing now, then you basically take away much of the money that the Taliban have that has enabled them to make their comeback. Where did their comeback come from in the last few years? Again, I cover Afghanistan daily, you know, and we do the updates. I'm the main one to do the updates on Afghanistan. And what's been going on here for the last 10 years is that the drug business has gotten bigger, the Taliban have integrated themselves with it, just like the FARC, the leftist rebel organizations in Colombia, ingratiated themselves with the drug gangs, who were quite separate and didn't really care about, you know, any leftist revolution. They just wanted to get rich. It's even a bigger thing in Afghanistan, because for these tribesmen up there, they've never seen money like this. Now, the money isn't distributed equally, but a lot of it is passed around. You got to take care of your tribe. And a lot of the gangs are very much tribal-based. Although there's also a changing of the generations with the tribes, there's tribal politics going on both sides of the border. That is secondary to the fact there's all this money sloshing around. It's the same thing you saw played out in American cities when crack hit. Or actually all through several phases of drugs, you know, washing into urban areas and all of a sudden bringing a lot of money within the reach of people who would otherwise be very poor because they didn't stay in school or whatever reason. So what McChrystal is doing now with all those additional troops is basically going after the low-hanging fruit in the drug business. Now, where it's going to get interesting towards the end of the year is these drug gangs, they do not want to give this up. Like I said, this is something they never thought they'd ever see. Now they have access to all the goodies in the world. They got their, you know, I mean, guys joke to me, you know, sending me emails, says, you can always tell who the local drug players are. It's the guys with the new compounds. These are these little fortresses you'll see all over the place. He says, all you got to do is look for the satellite dishes. And, you know, any sign of lots of new gadgets, new SUVs, they're your druggies. There's no other way to, you know, buy that kind of stuff, you know, unless you're, you know, involved in the drug business or a government official who's basically, you know, selling protection. But it's mostly the druggies, and taking these guys down is not just a matter of sending the troops out. You got to deal with Karzai and all of his kin who are being paid off by the drug gangs. So the entire society has been corrupted. Not everyone. But basically, it's just like, you know, Colombia all over again. It's insidious. They offer you gold or lead, and they do not want to give it up. And so it's gonna start playing out like, you know, something out of Shakespeare. You know, a lot of drama, you know, a lot of pathos, and a lot of gunfire. Well, that isn't Shakespeare, but you know what I mean.
Now, the rules.
I don't know. Shakespeare ends. I mean, think about Hamlet. It just ends with all the bodies stacked up on stage. That's pretty.
Well, yeah, the ancient Greeks had it too. It's just, you know, just so many things going wrong, and nobody gets out alive, as a more modern poet said.
Right. But
Dan, let me offer another line of analysis. I agree with everything Jim has said about the insidiousness of the drug business and what it does to quote-unquote local economies. It is because of the amount of money it becomes the local economy, because everybody else, there's only so much money in smuggling guns. I'm talking about the kind of AKs and Enfields and a few other things that they've smuggled, smuggling electronics, and smuggling different types of fuel, and there's more money in that than there is in goats, and that's not to try to...
Well, you remember, the drugs are different because they're bringing money into the country. The other kind of smuggling was just coming in, you know, bringing goods into for people who had money, which wasn't many.
Well, moving across. It's just a completely different... It's stratospherically different. You know, the other things I mentioned, the goats and the electronics, are so far down in compared to the amount of money that the drugs bring. That said, there are as Jim said, Afghanistan doesn't exist. Another way to look at it is it's a mosaic of a bunch of different Afghanistans, that some pieces of Afghanistan have long-term traditional, and it's even more sophisticated than quote-unquote saying traditional. Traditional can be quite sophisticated. Political relationships with one another, ways of doing business with one another. You can't even really draw a line, quote, between the North and the South, because then you're going to have to drop a line through the West, which has influence with Iranians as well as other Central Asian states. That said, there are also, and this is part of a change where it's not 19th century. It's not that there isn't 19th century and 12th century elements in play. folks understand there is a 21st century out there because of the information connectivity that we have now, whether it's expressed only in cell phones. And I know Dunnigan's got a great rap on cell phones in both Africa and in Central Asia, but it's not only expressed in cell phones, but ultimately in internet type connectivity. There are groups, and this is within the tribes, that are interested in quote-unquote modernity. They want modernity on their own terms, but modernity, Dan, comes down to I'd like medicine for myself and my kids. I'd like some electric lights. Well, this goes back to, do you build a grid for parts of Afghanistan that have never seen anything close to a grid? What grid there was has been destroyed largely by, well, it was destroyed in the Soviets' war in Afghanistan. But how do you meet that demand for electricity? And that demand for electricity breaks down into a lot of ways. It's not just light, but this is pretty sophisticated understanding of it. If you give me light in my home, now I have the opportunity for kids to actually learn to read at night. In other words, do homework if you've got ongoing schools, so that I increase the educational function. And the other thing is there are farming communities that aren't only growing poppies throughout Afghanistan. Their demand there from many of their farmers is, as I understand, if you help me, give me good agricultural advice, I can improve my own productivity, and then I have a surplus, and I have more. We're not so poor anymore. Now, that has been trying to meet these demands. Of course, you've got all the political issues out of the various groups contending in Kabul, and then you have ultra-damaged infrastructure. And even though there has been some improvement in terms of infrastructure, I mean in roads, not just in the grid. So you're fighting the issue of how do you reach many of these places. Well, the U.S. Finally settled on provincial reconstruction teams, which are a decentralized attempt at aiding meeting these demands for development and modernization. And the concept on the U.S. side, it's not just U.S., let's say the NATO or Western or modernizer side, you might even get the Chinese in on this, and the Indians, which is that those people who become connected are far less likely to be drawn into religious radicalization or other to support terrorists. The component that Jim brings up, though, the drugs just kind of screw up the entire slow process of modernization, because some guys are able to say, I've got a ton of money, hell, I can buy all this stuff right now, and at the same time, they're not interested in so much as cooperation as they're interested in protection. So this comes back to where the threads that I have described, the policy components, they're very real too. You do read about these in the mainstream media. We comment on them at strategypage.com. But the drug issue undermines a lot of your developmental effort. What I've described is more complicated than you get out of the five-paragraph story in the newspaper. But it's very real. And a journal like McChrystal, USAID is aware of this. All of many of the NGOs are very savvy about these issues inside Afghanistan. And now you're left with, well, gee, okay, we can do some of these things. We can begin to meet some of these demands for modernization. We want to encourage them, but the drug business undermines it, as well as their constant tribal spillover from Taliban, the Taliban in moving between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That dimension is still at play. One other comment, too, and I'd be interested to hear Jim's feedback on this. If you guys remember a column I wrote, I think it was last week, about some of Pakistan's changes vis-a-vis India after the Mumbai 2008 attack. It does look to me like the Pakistanis have been more enthusiastic and energized about putting pressure on the Taliban in the north and northwestern portions of Pakistan. And what that does is put pressure on it pressurized them, because some of the operations that we're conducting now in Helmand and then along the northwestern Pakistani Afghan border had put a real squeeze on the Taliban. I'd be interested in hearing Jim's feedback on that.
Yeah, they apparently have, some stuff's gotten out, and apparently the intel is that the Taliban in Helmand, which is where their money is, they couldn't put, thousands of armed guys into the field during the warm weather months without the money to pay them. These guys do not work for nothing, and even the guys who do work for nothing, they require money often for families or, again, to maintain morale. The Taliban will pay a few thousand bucks to the family of any guy that's killed, and that's a lot of guys getting killed each year. So they need the cash flow, and so they've been asking their friends, as it were, all over the country to attack, to basically try and, draw off the pressure. Of course, it's having no effect. They understand the basics of strategy, but they don't understand, in this case, the details. The guys operating, the Marines and Brits and Canadians, whatever, operating in Helmand, are not going to be affected by whatever attacks are going on in the other parts of the country. Indeed, all they're doing with those other attacks is annoying more Afghans. It's especially a problem in the north, where the Pashtuns and all their druggy stuff are not appreciated. Most of the northern non-Pashtun, again, remember, 60% of Afghans are not Pashtun. The Pashtuns, like the Serbs in old Yugoslavia, are the largest minority, and again, like the Serbs in Yugoslavia, they have to be paid attention to. That's why Karzai and many other senior officials are Pashtuns. They had to throw those guys some bones. But the majority of officials in the government are non-Pashtun. And this causes some rancor because these old ethnic divisions, still exist and they still mean something. So by the Taliban sending some guys up north to set off bombs and just shoot up things, this makes them even more unpopular than they are now. Setting up more suicide bombs in eastern Pakistan, which is Pashtun, but not as much into the Taliban because there's not as much drug activity there. This just again turns more Pashtun off from the Taliban. Most Afghans appreciate some of the things the Taliban are doing. Trying to impose order, that's good. Trying to drive out foreigners, that's good. Even if the foreigners are friendly foreigners, like we are. You got to remember, we are nothing like what the Russians were doing in the 1980s. We were invited to stay. We have basically very warm and cordial relations with the government of Afghanistan compared to what the Russians had. Now, the Russians had their own government in the 1980s, the communists. But the communists in Afghanistan were always disliked by the majority of the population because they are atheists. And we don't carry that baggage. I mean, the worst thing we have going for us is most of us are Christians, kafirs. But still, we are on good terms with the majority of Afghans, especially the non-Pashtuns and even a lot of the Pashtuns. They appreciate the good works we're doing. The Russians never did any good works. They burned things down. They drove 7 million people out. Once the Americans came in and our allies, millions of Afghans moved back to Afghanistan. So it's nothing like us and the Russians, but the idea of driving out foreigners, especially foreigners with guns, still plays. It's a knee-jerk thing. The Afghans have never liked foreigners. Historically, foreigners have always been nothing but trouble. The best thing you can expect from foreigners is they might have some interesting stuff you can steal from them if they don't kill you first. So that is just something that is in the blood. And Afghans like translators will joke about it with the GIs, they're working for. No offense, guys, but hey, you're foreigners. That's great loot you got there on your belt. And the GIs, learn a lesson, they laugh along, give the guy a gift, at the end of it, before they go home. That's how you play the game in Afghanistan. And long term, the Taliban are not going to win because they didn't win last time. I mean, I remember on 9/11 when the towers were getting hit. I was just doing an update on Afghanistan, which is irony of ironies, and I was reporting on Massoud, you know, the big leader, the big northern Tajik, I think he was. He had just been assassinated by Al Qaeda. A team of suicide bombers disguised as a camera crew. And but I was also reporting on why, after all these years, the Northern Alliance was still holding out. Hadn't the Taliban conquered all of Afghanistan? And that's what you read in the New York Times. I was explaining what was really going on there. And what was really going on there was the Taliban were making themselves unpopular. They cleaned up all the bandits and what have you when they got in there. They stopped the civil war. That was appreciated. But then they said, now we have to change the way you live. You're Muslims, but you're not good enough for us. So they started cutting out all the TV, all the music. Those of us old enough remember they blew up the Buddhist, bas reliefs up in central Afghanistan, which was
a
big state.
I was
exactly,
just,
yeah, the Buddhist.
Pronounced it, but that's the Buddhist, and those were a UNESCO, UN.
What did it come down to was at that point, on the day the towers came down, we were reporting that the Taliban were so unpopular that they had to use a brigade of Al-Qaeda fighters. In other words, when guys went to Afghanistan to be trained, go through several months of training, they were then, most of them, obliged to spend, 6 months or so serving in, I think it was the 35th Brigade of the Afghan Army. But they were all Arabs, mostly, Central Asians. Hardly any of them were Afghans. And these were the guys the Taliban could depend on to send around to a tribe that was giving them trouble, because no Afghan would do it. They said, hey, I go beat on this tribe. I got a blood feud going on forever with these guys. I got no beef with them. So, I mean, the Afghans are generally pretty good about that. So the Taliban understood this, and they said, well, we'll use these foreigners. They're pious Muslims. They're Al-Qaeda, and they don't mind killing Afghans. And off they go. And these guys were like the fire brigade running around. And then during the warm weather, the campaigning season, they'd go up and they'd lead the attacks against the Northern Alliance, which was more of a Pushtun versus the world sort of thing. The Pushtuns were more willing to go fight the Tajiks and the Uzbeks and the Hazara because they were always considered foreigners to Pushtuns. But to maintain Taliban power in Afghanistan, in 2001, they were using a foreign brigade of Al-Qaeda, gunmen. And that's how bad it was. So any Afghan who thinks about the Taliban thinks, these guys are bad news. And most Afghans, if you can ask them that, that's what they'll tell you.
Let's add another part to that. And we addressed this. We addressed this after 9/11, but you could also see a couple of posts touching on them. Remember, these Al-Qaeda guys, whether they draw them as Uyghurs from Western China, or Arabs from Saudi Arabia, or a collection of other places, even some of them coming from Jamaa Islamiya, some of the Southeast Asian affiliates certainly had trained in Afghanistan and were quote-unquote there with Al-Qaeda. The locals viewed him as foreigners, too. They had a cash advantage. It wasn't the drug war, but they had their petrodollars or bin Laden's fortune to do the same.
Islamic charities.
Yeah, kind of game of show up in the middle of nowhere and, hey, here's $15,000. Or if you really want it, here's $1 million and protect us, allow us to wage our jihad, and thanks for the money. And that's why they could buy protection, buy privileges as well. Now, protection is one thing, but the privileges, and then so many of the Arabs, particularly from Saudi Arabia, got deservedly bad raps because they treated the Afghan tribesmen, including the Pushtuns, as hillbillies.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't get out. We know about it. They certainly know about it. Our military knows about it because they've been told about it by the Afghans. I mean, I heard that when I've been in Afghanistan, but I also I knew that from the list from many sources about, hey, these guys are snobs. They are, quote-unquote, Muslim radical purist snobs. Well, they're violent snobs as well. We've seen that kind of a spoiled brat case that's violent, has money, and uses it. Some of the American, quote-unquote, terrorists in the late 60s and 70s follow that kind of, have that kind of personal and social component to them as well. You know, the rich kids are suddenly SDS radicals. If they showed up, they ticked off the locals because they were, you know, culturally backward hillbillies, and plus they didn't follow the right kind of Islam. One of the things Jim described, too, in the way the Taliban had been behaving, and not so much just with Al-Qaeda, is that earlier when I talked about how some of the mosaic of Afghanistan had tribal political relationships, knew how to relate with one another, the Taliban came in and rolled right over those, just like any kind of imperialist force that, not that they didn't know about them, they didn't want to recognize them, they thought they had the power to impose their will. Guess what? They found out that there were people who were willing to resist them.
There were two things going on there beyond that. One was the Arab arrogance also brought to the surface another problem in Islam, in that with the more, like with the Wahhabi, the more conservative forms of Islam, especially in the Arab world, take it as a pillar of, another pillar of faith, as it were, that all Muslims are equal, but Arab Muslims are more equal. In other words, you know, the Muslim scriptures are written in Arabic, and if you want to be really fluent with the religious studies, you have to learn Arabic. The Arabs take that one step beyond and say, it's not just the language. Us, we are holier than thou, because we are the children of the Prophet. Now, in missionaries in other parts of the world where there are Muslims, they're not going to play that up. They say, hey, we're all brothers. But, you know, that's something that basically...
It
became a big problem.
The democratic appeal of Islam. One of the Islam's ideals is that we're all equal to Allah. You know?
Yeah, and Al-Qaeda blew. Now, another problem with culture was the Taliban were basically coming from some tribes around Kandahar. Although they were recruited in the madrasas of Pakistan, where Afghan refugees were sitting waiting the war out, a lot of those initial Talib students were from the southern, were Pushtuns from southern Afghanistan, and the ones who basically, like Mullah Omar, the ones who took control of the Taliban movement tended to be the Kandahar Mafia, for want of a better term. And they have dominated. And what they have done, as far as many Afghans are concerned, is they are trying to impose their tribal customs on the rest of the country under the guise of this is correct Islam. And a lot of Afghans look at that and basically say, you know, the Afghan term for bullshit. You know, you guys just want us all to be like your flavor of Pushtun, which is nonsense. You know, we're all different. And I'm not going to run my family the way you run yours simply because you say I'm in charge. That never works in Afghanistan. Modern Afghanistan basically started in the 18th century when they formed a kingdom, when basically everybody got away because there was nothing left there, you know, to plunder. And so they said, all right, here's the deal they evolved, was we'll have a king of this new place we'll call Afghanistan, which basically didn't exist before that. It had many names, depending on what tribe's area you were in. And they say, all right, we'll take the strongest tribe, which was usually a Pushtun tribe. Their guy will be the king. His main job will be keep the foreigners out and basically help mediate, if a jirga doesn't, you know, a tribal council doesn't do it, help mediate tribal disputes. Beyond that, you leave us alone. Now, the Civil War in 1979 began when the government overthrew the king and said, all right, now we're the communists, we're taking over, and we're really going to run this country. Big mistake.
Well, that's 73. They said that the overthrow was in 73.
In the 70s,
the
right.
Russians invade in 79.
When the tribal people are saying, we're going to throw you out. And they cried to Mother Russia and said, hey, you know, this ain't working down here. Well, the basic conditions still apply. The Taliban, or even Karzai, this is something the Westerners have a hard time comprehending. An Afghan government isn't the same as a British government, a French government, American government, Chinese government, any other kind of government. It's sort of a non-government. It's the anti-government. And that's what Karzai has a hard time explaining. He says, you know, you guys have all these grandiose ideas. They're not going to work here. You know, we're talking about generations of effort before things fundamentally change. If you want to keep a lid on things, you got to start by doing it the Afghan way. And most Western, you know, helpers and NGOs look at that and say, what the hell are you talking about, you slick-tongued barbarian?
Well, Jim, I think that I've seen a change over the last few years, which I'm going to credit. I've seen NGOs, and what part of what McChrystal wants to pursue and part of what the PRT, Provincial Reconstruction Team idea is that you understand that it's you want to call them the anti-government. How about that it's a mediation government, which is what the whole idea was of the king.
Exactly.
It's a mediation government.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the way to state that.
But you can't expect the government to do anything in the Western sense.
That's right. But it's a mediation government, and still it can work. I think that's probably a good way to end this discussion. We've been going on for 30 minutes on a ton of things about Afghanistan. This
right.
is a typical discussion.
Afghanistan is different, and we've tried to explain in what ways.
Right. Now, the one thing that we left sort of hanging is, are the additional troops going to have that much of an effect on all of this?
Yes. They're making gangbusters with the druggies. The drug gangs are in turmoil right now. There have been two things are happening. One, they're interrupting business. The drug gangs were so cocky down in especially in Helmand, that they were running open marketplaces where the smuggling groups, there were separate gangs that do the smuggling, taking this stuff out of the country, would come in and haggle over buying, you know, we're talking tons, you know, they're moving thousands of, over 100 tons of heroin goes out of Helmand every month.
Wow.
And somebody's got to move it. It's got to be smuggled. You can't just, you know, boldly, you know, drive across the border and say, hey, I'm carrying horse. I mean, you can if you've bribed that particular guard. But that stuff's got to be used. So they're running it. So they have the drug labs. They got to bring in the chemicals, you know, over a ton of chemicals to convert the poppy, the opium into heroin. All this stuff is being done fairly openly. Now they got to start hiding it. Because we've destroyed many of those drug labs. I mean, there's been an interruption in the supply, which means they're not going to be getting. It's going to be a very dreary Christmas. I know it's Muslims; they don't celebrate Christmas, but it's going to be a dreary Christmas for them at the end of the year because their cash flow is getting hurt. They've had to reorganize the business. That's more money. They got to literally start going underground, hiding this stuff. And we're going to be. And the more troops we have there, the more helicopters we have there, the more UAVs we have there, which are coming in, the harder it is for them to hide. These chemical labs, we have plenty of experience finding these chemical labs because we've been chasing them all over the world. They don't have to do this kind of stuff with the cocaine, but we've been chasing these chemical labs ever since the Iron Triangle, you know, back in the 70s, which, again, people forget. The triangle up in China, Burma, and Thailand.
The Golden Triangle.
That was shut down. That used to be the source of 90% of the heroin. It isn't anymore. And that tells you something. You can shut these guys down. Now they move someplace else. But eventually, if there's no place else to move, it's like wiping out smallpox.
Right. Right. Well, hopefully we'll see the situation getting better, continuing to get better, and maybe someday they'll even find where Osama bin Laden is hiding out. But he's probably buried.
Right? Yeah, I hope that we just find his grave.